Hello, and welcome to Behind the News. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. The usual ration of two guests up today. First, in a few minutes, we'll hear from Nicholas Carr, author of The Shallows, on what the Internet is doing to our brains, in the words of the subtitle. And at the bottom of the hour, Robert Faton of the University of Virginia will talk about Haiti, the return of Jean-Claude Bébé-Doc Duvalier, the almost complete lack of reconstruction after last January's horrendous earthquake, and the worsening social and political crisis in that country, which, given where it all started, is saying a lot. Just a few quick words of the news, because we've got lots of interview product packed into today's show. It's been a while since I mentioned unemployment insurance claims, that sensitive short-term indicator of the state of the job market. Last week, 404,000 applied for unemployment insurance, down 37,000 from the week before. This number bounces all over the place at the end of one year and the beginning of another. There's all that holiday retail hiring in November, followed by post-Christmas layoffs for one, and a normal spike in layoffs at year-end for two, since employers repeatedly don't want to ruin people's holidays by giving them pink slips before Christmas. The Labor Department does its best to adjust for this pattern in order to isolate underlying trends, but the process is imperfect, so it's hard to figure out what's really going on until late January or early February. But in any case, it does look like the job market is continuing to improve, though slowly, from miserably distressed levels. Measures of consumer attitudes are also improving slowly, also from miserably distressed levels, which seems like a pretty accurate reflection of underlying economic reality. And the various leading indexes, which forecast the direction of economic activity several months out, have been rising, suggesting that the trend of modest improvement is likely to continue into the summer. Of course, any number of things could go wrong. Spain could always join Greece and Ireland in the intensive care unit. Given Spain's considerably greater size, that could throw Europe into a very serious crisis with worldwide implications. Or China could take a bad turn, something that's frequently predicted but hasn't yet happened. Or a major U.S. state could have trouble servicing its debts, producing a major financial panic. Who knows? One oddly bright spot of the U.S. economic picture is a strong recovery in manufacturing. I say oddly because this sector has been on the ropes for decades. Over the last year, the Federal Reserve's Index of Industrial Production is up almost 6%, and that's adjusted for inflation. The strength isn't particularly concentrated in just a few sectors, either. If this isn't just a flash in the pan, then it could mean a firming foundation for the rest of the U.S. economy, a reversal of the hollowing out that started in the 1970s. In an attempt to encourage the manufacturing revival, Barack Obama has appointed GE boss Jeffrey Immelt as head of the President's Council on Jobs and Competitiveness. This is being spun as part of Obama's efforts to reverse perceptions that he's been too hard on business. That sort of claim is always good for a laugh. It's really hard to come up with any examples of how the president has been anything but worshipful in his treatment of capital. But these business types are so sensitive. They require frequent public displays of affection to keep their egos from feeling bruised. Immelt will no doubt ask the president to cut taxes for the likes of him and his company and to ease the regulations that are always described as burdensome. And it's likely, too, that our eager-to-please president will go along. And it's also likely that business interests and their pet politicians will complain that it still isn't enough. It's the timeless music of American politics. Okay, let's take a break, and we'll be back to talk about internet-driven brain rot. That was some of La Tigra singing Get Off the Internet from about 10 years ago. I'm actually not likely to do that, and if you're listening to this on the web, I hope you don't either. But there are consequences to all this connectivity, as they say in the trade. Here to talk about all that is Nicholas Carr. Carr is author of The Shallows, What the Internet is Doing to Our Brains, published by Norton. It's not quite a new book. It came out last June, but it's a very good and important one that examines from several perspectives, neurochemistry, psychology, and old-fashioned reflection, what the net is doing to our minds and our culture. He tells some of the story in this interview, but it's worth getting the full dose by reading the book. I don't always say that, but this time I will. Besides, reading books is a good antidote to all the toxins that Carr describes. Nicholas Carr. You write a rather interesting history of reading in your book. We didn't always sit quietly and read texts the way we do now, or did until recently. Could you give us the capsule rundown of this?
Reading first was a way, was simply an extension of oral culture. So it was a way to document what was spoken. And in the way writing first emerged, it very much reflected this attempt to simply to transcribe speech. So, for instance, there were no spaces between words. And as a result, reading was a very difficult, cognitively challenging process. You had to, you know, figure out where one word ends and the next begins. And as a result of that, most reading, in fact, pretty much all reading, was reading that was done out loud. So it was still a kind of a way to continue oral culture in that sense as well. And it was only until about 800 or 900 AD that scribes began to put spaces between words, and suddenly a new form of reading emerged, silent reading, solitary reading. The phenomenon of sitting down with a book or an article and quietly reading it is really quite a new phenomenon in human history.
And now the experience of the web is obviously very, very different. Jody Dean says that in talking about blogs and other forms of web writing, that people pay too much attention to content. We need to also pay attention to the structure of the thing. There's the linking, the constant references to other blogs and such. The graphics. It's very busy in contrast to the printed page. There's a great demand for novelty. What does this do to the experience of reading?
I think there is a sense that the form of writing doesn't matter, a popular sense. So everybody focuses on the content, and so there's this assumption that reading is the same on screen versus on printed page. But I think that's wrong. I think it's actually very different. And in some way, you're absolutely right that when you look at how the written word is presented on screen, and particularly through the internet, it tends to be wrapped in multimedia. It tends to have lots of links. And in some ways, this returns us, I think, to that earlier form of reading that was very cognitively intensive. In other words, when you read online and you're deciphering links and you're jumping from page to page and your eyes are shifting to look at some video stream or you're listening to something, a lot of your problem-solving parts of your brain are active and you're making constant decisions. And there's nothing wrong with that per se, but what it does, I think, is it intrudes to the form, the deepest kind of reading that you get when you're very much solely concentrated on the words. And this is the kind of deep reading that emerged with the arrival of the book, and particularly the printed book. So what I fear happens when we read on screen is we lose the kind of deeply interpretive aspect of reading that really does require very tight attentiveness to the text. And instead, we have a very different form of reading emerge, which is in some ways a more primitive form, where your most of your attention goes to decoding, simply decoding what you're reading, rather than getting beyond that to the more profound interpretive skills of deep reading.
I had an experience a few months ago where a friend sent me a scanned passage from a book, and I had trouble reading it. It was Harold Bloom's book on Yeats, and this is a book I read years ago, and something I found eminently comprehensible. But then I was looking at this excerpt on the screen, I just couldn't make sense of it. And I was wondering if my brain was deteriorating or something. And then I got a copy of the book a few days later and read the passage on the page, and I found it perfectly comprehensible. Do you have any thoughts on this experience, or is there something about the nature of the pixels on the screen, or something about the expectations I brought to reading on the screen that made it such a different experience from the page?
My guess is that it's less about the pixels and more about the expectations, more about how you and the rest of us, for that matter, have kind of trained ourselves to read and to take in information when we're looking at a screen. And what we've essentially trained our brains to do, I think, and our brains are eminently trainable, is to expect to shift our focus constantly, to juggle lots of different things, to jump around. And when we try to concentrate, when we try to read in a very linear, attentive fashion, you can almost, you know, feel your brain rebelling against that. I've even felt that when I go away from a screen and sit down with a book or with a printed page of any sort, it's very hard to kind of get my brain back, my mind back in the very attentive reading mode. It still, even when I'm not in front of a screen, wants to kind of jump around and becomes very resistant to deep focus on one thing.
Yeah, you mentioned that several friends have said this to you. You obviously are a very literate and well-read guy. I've felt the same thing. I talk to friends who have the same experience. All this experience of reading on the screen and being exposed to information through the Internet has really changed the way we read texts, even when we're away from the computer.
I think it has. In some ways, paying attention to one thing is an unnatural use of our minds, because you can imagine, you know, in very primitive stages of our history, you wanted to constantly shift your focus. You wanted to be aware of as many different things going on around you in the environment as possible, simply because that's the way you stayed alive and spotted predators and found food and so forth. And so I think in a way the printed page, the arrival of printed page, trained us cognitively to do something that went against the grain, the natural grain of our minds, and that was to focus on one thing, whether it's a story or an argument or any other kind of line of thought. And so I think one of the reasons we take so readily to the screen and one of the reasons it influences so much is it, in a sense, it returns us to a more natural way of taking in information, very scattered, constantly shifting our focus, constantly shifting our attention. And so in a way, this very modern, very new technology encourages, I think, a more primitive form of thinking, and that's reflected in the reading styles we adapt, both when we go online and even when we turn off our computer.
Yeah, I remember the early days of MTV. The videos were just the pace of the editing was so rapid. A scene lasted no more than a second or two very often, and that seemed to have an effect on people's ability to follow narratives. Is this similar, or is there something different about our experience on the web?
I think in one sense it's similar. I don't think the web is the beginning of this trend to kind of shorter, briefer bursts of attentiveness and constantly shifting focus. I think you could make an argument that the entire history of modern media, going back 100 years or so, has been a story of shrinking attention spans and more distractions impinging upon our consciousness. And so from that respect, I think that what the web does is simply accelerate a trend that's been around for a long time. What's different about the web, different even from television and radio and so forth, is that increasingly as computers have shrunk to the size of cell phones and smartphones and so forth and laptops and everything else, we carry the technology around with us all day long. These kind of constant bursts of interruption and distraction aren't relegated to, you know, a portion of our day when, for instance, we might be sitting in front of the TV or whatever. Now it's kind of the atmosphere or the environment we're in during all of our waking hours more and more.
Yeah, I was stunned to learn in your book that people are tweeting in concert halls and churches now.
And not only that, but in some cases they're being encouraged to tweet. They tell a story of a church that has screens and they roll tweets and other messages from the congregation as the sermon is going on. And similarly, we're beginning to see in concert performances, even classical music performances, an encouragement of people to use their cell phones to make comments or to vote on, you know, an encore or whatever. And what it shows you is that our social norms and expectations begin to shape themselves around the technology. So what would have once been considered either rude or simply strange, you know, the desire to fiddle around with a gadget while listening to a symphony or something, suddenly starts to seem normal.
Now, the boosters would suggest that this is there's something democratic about this. Do you buy that?
In some ways, I think there is. I mean, one of the reasons the web, the net, personal computers have such a big influence on the way we think is because they're so useful and in many ways so beneficial. And I think if you look, for instance, at the way that the web has made it so much easier and so much cheaper to publish or broadcast your thoughts and ideas, there certainly is a democratizing force there. I mean, there are plenty of people who are writing interesting things, who are uploading interesting videos and so forth, that wouldn't have been able to do that not so long ago and certainly wouldn't have been able to find an audience. So even if most of it isn't, most of the stuff being published on the online and so forth isn't particularly interesting, and a lot of it is garbage, there's still, and it's important to acknowledge, it still freed a lot of people to express themselves in ways that weren't possible before.
I'm speaking with Nicholas Carr, author of The Shallows. People used to think that the brain, once you reach maturity, was pretty much fixed in its structure and behavior. In recent years, we've learned that the brain is far more plastic than that. And some of the things we've been talking about actually have neurochemical analogs or roots. What is the attention that the web imposes doing to our brain structures?
Well, what we know about our brains now is that they adapt to circumstances, and they adapt to changes in the environment. They adapt to changes in what we do, including the different tools we use. One of the fundamental qualities of the human brain is that it's very efficient. So when we take on new habits, in particular new habits of mind, we strengthen the circuits, to speak metaphorically, or the neural pathways that support those new activities. But on the other hand, if we stop doing something, some mode of thinking, or do it less, then those neural pathways begin to weaken as the brain kind of pulls those resources, so to speak, to support the more active processes we're engaged in. So I think if you look at the nature of the web as a technology, and as a technology, because we use it so intensively and so often and so repetitively, I think what we know about brain plasticity is it probably has a quite strong effect in reshaping our neural pathways. What you have to assume, I think, and these things are very hard to get direct scientific evidence because, of course, not very many people want to have scientists fiddling around with their brain cells during the course of a day or anything. But what you have to assume is that we're, in essence, optimizing our minds for being distracted, for multitasking, for taking in lots of information very, very quickly. This is what we're rewarding our brains for doing when we're online. But on the other hand, the processes, the cognitive processes, the mental processes that we're not exercising or are exercising less, which are the deeply attentive forms of thinking, stuff like contemplation, reflection, introspection, those are the skills that we're probably seeing being eroded by all the time we spend online. And so as has been the case, I think, in the past with technologies, a technology emphasizes certain ways of thinking, and we get better at those ways of thinking, but it de-emphasizes other ones, which it's not good at. And in the case of the web, what's being emphasized is skimming and scanning and multitasking, and what's being de-emphasized is the more focused, more concentrated, more contemplative ways of thinking.
Now, there are people like, Clay Shirky, who, despite teaching at a prestigious university, thinks that all that time we spent reading Proust and Tolstoy was kind of a waste, and now we can liberate ourselves from them. What do you say to Clay Shirky?
Well, I've thought about, what Shirky says and what other people like him say. And in one way, I want to reject it outright because it seems like such a, almost an expression of Philistinism that you simply dismiss these great works of culture because they're no longer technologically current or whatever. But on the other hand, I think is going on here when you see what are clearly very intelligent people kind of dismissing great works of literature and so forth is that this may be the first generation of intellectuals who have been raised on screens rather than through books, and maybe what we're seeing is the first wave of a kind of unfortunate in my view, but cultural reconsideration that begins to see short form works, stuff, interactivity and so forth as being the core of culture, and begins to be dismissive about works of art and works of literature that actually require more solitary, more contemplative, more attentive ways of thinking.
Let's talk a little bit about Google. First of all, some of the boosters claim that we don't really need to remember anything anymore because we've got Google to serve as our sort of surrogate memory. What does that do to our thought?
What we know about our brains is that our memory is at the very core not only of our kind of conceptual thinking and critical thinking, but even of the richness of our intellectual life, and I think of the richness of our personality. And it's through the distinctive connections we make as individuals between the facts and the experiences and the emotions that we hold in our own biological personal memory that we do get distinctive ways of thinking and feeling and perceiving the world. And so there's this, under the force of this new technology, computer technology, that also has something called memory, what we're seeing is a desire to view our human biological memory as kind of the same as computer memory. And so, and when you take that view, all of a sudden personal memory becomes replaceable by computer memory because it's just this storehouse of individual objects that we just draw on whenever we need to. And it seems to me that this is one of the most dangerous ways that the web and computers are reshaping our perception of ourselves. We're suddenly coming to say, hey, I don't need to remember anything. It doesn't matter if there's nothing in my personal memory because I can go Google it on the web in 2 seconds. And unfortunately, what that means is a loss of individual connections inside our own minds and having those replaced by the kind of generic scripted connections that you have on the web. And I think inevitably, if we move down this road very, very far, where we devalue personal memory, we're going to become less interesting as thinkers and probably less interesting as people.
It used to be the aspiration of people who worked in artificial intelligence was to make machines that think like humans, but it may be that we're going to make humans that think like machines.
That's what I fear, is that we begin to see our own minds as working like computers. And as soon as you do that, I think you begin to put the stress on what we value about computers, which is the efficiency with which they can take in information and spew out calculations and other information. And so as we kind of adopt that as our reigning metaphor for our own minds, then I think we begin to take what is, in essence, I think, the Google view of intelligence, which is that it's all about efficiency, it's all about the fast finding of bits of information for immediate problem solving. And what becomes lost in that is the most human ways of thinking that isn't about efficiency, but is more open-ended and about making sense of things and coming up with your own ideas and weaving together thoughts. And so you could argue that, you know, what this means is that we're beginning, as the more we use computers, the more we resemble computers.
What about Google's project of scanning a large chunk of the world's books? What are the consequences of thinking of libraries as a kind of giant database?
First, I should say that there are a lot of benefits to what Google's doing, and in many ways, I don't think they're doing it for bad intentions or anything, even though ultimately they want to make money off it. There is a great number of benefits to researchers, to writers like myself, of being able to quickly find particularly old books that are very difficult to find when you have to search through libraries. So there are great benefits of bringing works of literature online. The drawback is that, and you see this when you use the Google Books service, is that as with everything, Google sees books as kind of information to be mined quickly. And so you do a search on a book and it brings you to a particular page or a particular passage, and surrounding that page are all the distractions you get with the web, all sorts of tools, all sorts of social networking services, search boxes, and so forth. And what seems to be missing from Google's view of books is the idea that a book is something to be taken in as a whole and is something to be concentrated on. And instead, you get this model of the book as just more web pages, and each of which contains bits of information that might be useful in response to a particular search that you're doing at a time. So it's kind of the dismemberment of the book and the dismemberment of the experience of reading a book.
And what, if anything, can we do about this? Are we completely at the mercy of the technology? I mean, in many ways, I love it. You know, I love computers. I love the Internet. But on the other hand, I'm extremely concerned about the things we've been talking about. Is there a way we can master it, or is it destined to master us, and we're going to become a society of shallow and easily distracted people?
There's one school of thought that says, oh, technologies are inert and neutral, and it's all about how we use them. That gives us a little too much credit. In fact, and you see this over and over again with all sorts of technologies, the automobile and so forth, the technology reshapes our expectations. It reshapes our behavior. In something like the web, just like books in the past, reshapes the way we think. So it's not totally in our control, and it's not totally a matter of just personal choice and personal discipline. Having said that, I do think that, you know, we are human beings who can exert our choice and can exert our discipline. And as individuals, I think we can make choices about when and how we use different technologies, including computers and smartphones and the Internet. And what has to be recognized, though, is that what we're seeing is that the expectation of kind of always being connected to constant streams of information is starting to be woven very deeply into social norms. Many people, when they go to work, the expectation is, or even when they're away from their job, the expectation is that they're going to be following their colleagues and their jobs online through constant emailing and so forth. And in people's social lives, and this is particularly true of the young, increasingly social lives are built around computer networking. So your friends are planning their social lives through Facebook and Twitter and texting and so forth. And as that happens, as our expectations change to incorporate ever more the expectation of connectedness, it becomes harder and harder as individuals to break away, because you might feel like you're damaging your career or damaging your social life, which is something most people don't want to do. So it's, again, as individuals, we can change our habits, we can control how we use technology, but as a society, we seem to be going in the direction of ever more valuing kind of constant connectedness, constant multitasking, and placing less emphasis on and placing less value on more contemplative and more solitary ways of thinking.
That was Nicholas Carr, author of The Shallows, which was published by W.W. Norton last June. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break to talk about Haiti. That was the first of the three avant-dernier pensées, penultimate thoughts, by Eric Satie, performed by Daniel Varsano. And apologies for my brutalization of the French. My next guest is Robert Faton. And yes, his first name is usually pronounced in English and the last in French. Faton, a professor of politics at the University of Virginia, was on this show a year ago, just after a massive earthquake struck his native Haiti, to talk about how the political and social structure of the country had magnified the damage caused by nature. His 2002 book, Haiti's Predatory Republic, is an excellent examination of why the country is so hopelessly poor. Robert Faton, what do you make of the return of Baby Doc? It struck me as something very surprising. Was it to you?
I was absolutely stunned when I heard that he was coming back. I couldn't understand why he was coming back at that particular time to Haiti. And I couldn't understand either how he could have exited France, slept in Guadeloupe, taken a French plane and landed in Haiti, and then essentially welcomed in Haiti, escorted by national police to the best hotel in Haiti, the Caribe. That was very puzzling. There were all kinds of rumors about why that was happening, but so far I don't think anyone quite understand why that happened. And obviously what was even more puzzling is that after 24 hours, the Haitian police moved against him and he's been charged, as you know, of embezzlement, of corruption, etc., etc.
The man is clearly a murderer and a thief. How did he expect to be greeted?
Well, you see, I think that there might have been a feeling that there was some sort of political vacuum in Haiti at that, currently, given the crisis after the earthquake, the cholera epidemic, the electoral process, which was completely bungled, and fraudulent election. So it may be that he assumed that he was going to return and there was going to be some sort of massive popular support for him. And clearly there is no massive popular support for Duvalier. But he does have some support among some powerful people, from former members of the army, former Makouts that survived the so-called déchoucage when he left. So he does have sectors who wouldn't be unhappy to see, not necessarily Jean-Claude Duvalier, but a regime of the kind that he had when he was in power return at this particular time.
I was reading in the New York Times that there's, at least in some circles, nostalgia for the Duvalier days, as if they were somehow better than the last couple of decades. Is there any truth to that, or is the Times just inventing things?
Well, the thing is that nostalgia is very weird. You know, you forget the atrocious nature of the Jean-Claude years. You forget the repression. There was stability for a long while, but it was the stability of silence, and no one could really challenge the regime. There was massive corruption, but there was nonetheless stability. And the incredible thing, clearly, is that the material conditions of Haitians, which was quite bad under Jean-Claude, has probably worsened in the last 25 years, in particular after the earthquake and with the cholera epidemic. And I was back in Haiti a few weeks ago, and you can sense a feeling of anger about the current regime, about the political class, about the foreign community, about the interference of the major powers in Haitian politics. So there is clearly, the country is reaching a boiling point. And when you add Jean-Claude to it, it really creates a very dangerous situation. And it may well be that's exactly what people around Jean-Claude are hoping for, complete instability. And in that moment of crisis, the possibility of emerging, as it were, as an alternative. But I just don't see it that way. I don't think he's an alternative, and I don't see him at all capable of mustering significant popular support.
Now, it's a little over a year since the earthquake. From what I understand, there's been virtually no reconstruction of Haiti. You mentioned the cholera epidemic. What's been going on? Why are things so paralyzed?
Well, I think there are several reasons why. One is that in the first place, you have a government that is extremely weak and extremely incompetent. So you have that reality. And most institutions that existed prior to the earthquake, which were already extremely fragile, have virtually disappeared. So you have a system now where you have you have virtually no state capable of making any significant decisions. And most Haitians, as you know, call the country La République, the NGO, I mean the ONG Republic. And all of those NGOs may be quite good at emergency relief, but they have virtually no idea of how to coordinate the massive effort which is required to construct and reconstruct the country. They do their own thing. There is no coordination. So ultimately what you have are pockets of money here and there assisting Haitians, but no real national reconstruction. In order to have a national reconstruction, you really need some sort of legitimate state with some strong institutions. In addition to that, you have the overwhelming presence of the foreign community, I mean the so-called interim Haitian recovery organism that is led by Bill Clinton, and they have not really delivered, not only in terms of money, they've delivered very little so far, but also in terms of the programs that they are really pushing for. They are very much the old programs that actually were implemented in one way or another under Jean-Claude Duvalier, that is to say, use very cheap labor in Haiti and export. There is very little that has been done about agriculture, which is essential if you want to feed the population and becoming self-sufficient. So you have virtually the same old economic program that was a failure then and which is likely to be another failure. So if you don't change those things, you have a recipe for a continued crisis.
Bill O'Reilly on Fox has been signing off for the last few days about what he calls about $1.5 billion of foreign aid that has just disappeared as it's made its way through Haiti. Is he telling the truth? Have massive sums disappeared?
Well, there are all kinds of accusations of corruption, and I have no doubt that there is some corruption. But when you look at the amount of money that has been given to Haiti, most of it actually doesn't even stay in the country. It really comes back immediately to the donors. It has been estimated that of the emergency money in the first few months after the earthquake, something like $700 million came from the United States, but only about something like 1% went to the Haitian government. So you're talking about minimal amount of money going to the government. Most of the money is channeled through the NGOs. And that's a very serious problem because the assumption is that NGOs are significantly more honest than any government, but that's really, I think, a myth. There's a lot of money that has been spent from the NGO and wasted. And a lot of the money that the NGOs had received after the earthquake has never been distributed. Only about 38% of the total amount has found its way to Haiti, and as I've said, a significant portion of that 38% doesn't stay in the country. It's a very weird circulation of the money. The money is given to the NGOs, and the NGO buys stuff from the United States or Canada or France. So it's kind of a vicious circle. You may, in fact, with that money, alleviate the most extreme consequences of poverty and of the earthquake, but on the other hand, you do not generate any type of productive activity in Haiti itself. You import everything virtually in Haiti. So this is one of the huge problems that people talk about massive assistance. There was a lot of money given, but most of it doesn't stay in the country, and most of it is channeled through the NGOs.
I usually don't ask this kind of question, but if listeners want to contribute some money to helping Haiti in its dire straits, is there any channel or mechanism that they can contribute to, or is it all just going to go down the drain?
Well, I think there are plenty, there are some notable exceptions. Paul Farmer's outfit has done excellent work in Haiti. And one of the things that they've done is that they've trained Haitians to take over. And very few, actually, of the NGOs have done that. So it's not as if all NGOs are bad guys, as it were. But there is a structural problem with the NGOs, is that they cannot really have a national plan for the country. They have their own localized plans, and they don't coordinate. So you have kind of a chaotic situation. There are camps which are fairly well off in Haitian terms, but there are other camps which are absolutely horrible. It depends on where the money is going, and that depends on which NGO is where. So you lack that coordination. You lack the overall vision of the country. And when you look at, as I've said, the plans that have been elaborated for the reconstruction of Haiti, they are very much the old plans that have very little hope to generate really a systematic transformation of the country and its social structure. So the basic problems of Haiti are still here. That is to say, the huge chasm that exists between the vast majority of the population and a small minority. You have a huge divide between the rural areas and the urban areas. The urban areas are in very bad shape, but the rural areas are in worse shape than that. So when you have a country that is so fundamentally divided along class lines and then along urban and rural areas, it's difficult to see how you can extricate yourself from the crisis. So the bottom line is that the whole thing is really very political. You need a plan of reconstruction that would take into account the vast majority of the Haitian population, and that is certainly not what we have at the moment. This is a plan that Haitians have had very little to do to begin with in terms of its elaboration, let alone the popular sectors and the peasantry. If you look, for instance, at the composition of the interim commission, which is a fundamental organism in that reconstruction, you'll see that there is not a single member from the peasantry in that organism, which is rather shocking when you have 60% of the population which is still composed of peasants. So you can immediately see that this is the type of plan that is really a plan in the interest of a small group of people in the urban areas. And they may even be well-meaning, but the reality is that if you concentrate resources again in the urban areas with cheap wages, you're going to continue to see that massive migration from the rural sector to the urban areas, and there would be very few jobs. And this is the tragedy of the earthquake. I mean, look at Port-au-Prince, a city constructed for probably 250,000, 300,000 people, 3 million people, most of them unemployed, living in the slums. And with the earthquake that led to the tragedy that we know, over 300,000 people killed in it. And there is very little to indicate that we are moving in a different direction.
I'm speaking with Robert Fenton, who is a professor at the University of Virginia. Let's talk a bit about politics. There was an election last November. The results are still inconclusive. What happened, and who is going to be counting the votes?
Well, the election was quite poorly run. I mean, it was very disorganized. It was an election also that a massive fraud, and very few people actually voted. And in addition, you had several parties which had been banned to begin with, and one of the key parties, obviously, is the Lavalas party, that was banned. On the other hand, there were former members of Lavalas who ran for the presidency, and some of them also ran for the Congress and for the Senate. Now, what happened during the election was a rather interesting phenomenon that would clearly indicate again that the Haitian political class is rather opportunistic. On November 28, as you know, people went to vote, and by noon, as it were, some of the candidates decided that the election was not good. So you had 13 of them who decided that the thing didn't work and that they would ask for the cancellation of the election and for new elections. And then news filtered in barely 12 hours that two of the candidates, the candidate who is now leading, Mirlan Maniga, and Sweet Mickey, that is Michel Martelly, who is a popular compas singer, and that's the name of the popular Haitian music, they found out that, in fact, they could be and number one and number two. So overnight, both of them decided, well, the elections were not that bad. So there was a the complete change in the equation. And the other candidate was the candidate, the other main candidate is Jules Celestin, the candidate picked by the current president, René Préval. So those three guys, those three people were in fact the leading candidates. And the Electoral Council announced that Miralem Maniga came in first and Jules Celestin came number two and Michel Martelly came number three. Now, given the electoral system in Haiti, only the first two can go to the next round of the presidential election. And this is where the crisis really began, because Martelly decided that, in fact, he was number two. So Martelly went into the street, that created problems, and there were moments of volatility. So ultimately the decision was made by President Préval to ask the Organization of American States to look at the results. This is another controversial move. And the Organization of American States initially, apparently, because there was a report that was leaked, indicated that Miralem Maniga had come in first with about 30%, and number two was actually Sweet Mickey instead of Jules Celestin. But the difference between Jules Celestin and Martelly was simply reversed. In the earlier tally, Jules Celestin came in with about 22% and Martelly with 21.7 or something like that. And with DOS, the thing was reversed. And initially, the assumption was that DOS was going to compel President Préval to accept that change. And that ultimately has not happened. The OS had a press conference at the National Palace in Haiti, and what they said is that, well, this is what we think happened, but the official results will be decided by Haitian authorities. And it's not clear now what is going to happen. If I had a bet, I would assume that it's going to be Maniga, Celestin, or there will be some creative thinking saying that there is an electoral tie between Jules Celestin and Sweet Mickey, so you have a round of three people instead of two. I don't see Préval accepting the idea that his candidate would not be in the running. And I think what has been happening with Duvalier and the fact that his move against Duvalier may have given him some ammunition to push his candidate and to try to see if, in fact, his candidate is not going to ultimately win. But the elections were quite bad, horrific.
Does the OAS mean the United States, or is the process more plural than that?
It's a complicated business there, because, you see, the OAS is very much really the power of the United States, but you have rising Latin American powers, the Brazilians and the Chileans, who are very important actors in Haiti. I mean, the troops, the UN troops in Haiti are really dominated by the Brazilians and by the Chileans. And the Brazilians have a different agenda than the Americans. There is some room for maneuver. And if you followed recently the events of the UN in Haiti, there was a Brazilian representative of the UN who was ultimately forced out of his job as a result of declarations which really were quite critical about the international community, the power of the United States, and how they were treating the existing government. So that is an indication that you do have tensions. But clearly, when you're talking about the OAS, the big power, there's no doubt about it, is the United States. And the other major factors in the international community are the French and the Canadians. And the French clearly must have played a role in the return of Jean-Claude.
What would the French interest be in the return of that figure?
This is the puzzle. I mean, the French ambassador keeps on saying that they didn't know anything about it, that the plane was virtually in Haiti when they heard about it. But this is, I think, disingenuous. Duvalier had a passport which had expired, and they want us to believe that he could have just gone to Guadeloupe, spent the night there, taken the plane to Haiti, gone through custom, with an expired passport at this time in the history of Haiti, which is really at a point of acute political crisis. And the French would not have known about that. And even if he had taken the plane, not told, it was an Air France plane, they could have simply said to the plane to return. There is a puzzle here that we have not resolved yet. The only possibility is that you're talking about gross incompetence. And that may well be the case, and that one should never underestimate the capacity of events to be generated by incompetence. But in this instance, I have a hard time believing that the French didn't know about it. And the question is, if they knew about it, why didn't they do something? And they didn't do much.
Is politics in Haiti mostly a matter of dueling elites, or is there any mechanism or forum for popular expression?
Well, in Haiti, I mean, the press is absolutely free. If you go to Haiti, it's really one of the things that is there, the fundamental difference between the Duvalier period. But you don't have any really structured political parties. You have leaders, as it were, and they have a political party, and that political party is based on clientelistic and personalistic ties. But you don't have structured parties. The thing that comes closest to that may have been at one point Famila Valas, the party of Aristide. But even that was very much a party that was dominated by the personality of Aristide. So once Aristide left the country, Lavalas has been deeply divided, and they have multiple candidates, multiple groupuscules. So Lavalas was more of a popular movement, and Aristide was really the head, the charismatic leader that kept it going. And that is one of the problems with Haitian politics, that you only have major figures and nothing structured. And most of those figures ultimately represent interests that are not necessarily those of the vast majority of the population.
And finally, Haiti is a country obviously in need of a massive political and economic restructuring from the most fundamental and profound way. Are there any forces in the society, even potential forces, that could give rise to such a thing, or is it looking pretty blank right now?
Well, you have some movements, popular movements, but they don't have a lot of resources. And when you're looking at the country now, the degree of disintegration and of poverty is such that most people really don't have the time to organize. They really spend most of their time trying to survive. And that is an exhausting process. So most of the organizations that could, in fact, make a change tend to be fairly small. On the other hand, there is, and you can feel it in the air, there is a mood in Haiti that things cannot go on the same way, that things have to drastically change. The question is precisely that. How do you generate that change, and in what direction? And so far, we do not have the parties, we do not have the popular structures yet that can capture that mood and lead to a fundamental transformation of the country. When you look at the election that we had, you're talking about fundamentally similar programs. That is to say, no program at all. Accepting the harsh reality of Haitian dependence on the World Bank, the Interim Commission. So you do not sense so far the rise of a movement that would really be a real alternative for the vast majority of Haitians.
And the elite is just totally corrupt and self-interested.
Well, the elite doesn't sees only its immediate self-interest. There are some businessmen who you might call nationalists in the sense that they would want to see a different Haiti, but there are very few, and their interest clearly is not necessarily one that ultimately can be reconciled to the interests of the very poor. And the existing political class is also quite old when you think about it. And Haiti is a country with a majority of people who are not older than 25. So there is a big divide, to a generational divide, that is quite problematic, because you have that huge number of young people who mostly have no jobs, no educational opportunities, and are extremely frustrated. And that divide adds to the class divide, it adds to the regional divide, and the urban and rural divide. So it's a society that has been deeply fractured by events. And the earthquake, unfortunately, has not had that kind of shock to the system. I mean, one could have hoped immediately after the earthquake that people would have realized that something fundamental needed to be done to transform Haiti. And I think for a few weeks there was the possibility, but ultimately the old reflexes and the old class antagonisms and regional antagonism, I think, have reappeared. It's as if the earthquake has only exacerbated the conditions, and the opportunity that it might have created has not ultimately been seized.
That was Robert Fetton, a professor in the Department of Politics at the University of Virginia. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. During the interview, Robert Fetton discussed the presidential campaign of the musician Michel Martelly, known as Sweet Mickey. Martelly is, politically speaking, not a good guy. He's in tight with the Haitian elite and an opponent of former President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. But still, let's go out with this bit of his song, and pardon my mangled Creole, which is as bad as my French, Pas Manien Femme Non. Till next week, bye.
Aïti que les gars souffrent, n'a trop pas de nos gens à nager, c'est la profilée. Nous jouons des à la famille, des affaires des mondes gondrés, Dieu décide où il y a de bon silence. En pleine sarénale, la chèvre frappe, nous avons envie de mes soins bloqués, ils vont pas dans la lèvre, la chance.
Parfois important comme ça,
la loi pour cochon de ça, ou pas que nous avons qu'à que c'est comme ça.